Welcome to the first episode of Nonstop with Pooja. And with me, I have my very first guest, lecturer Dr. Angela Zemnitel. She's a very good friend and a mentor. She has many accolades to her name, but the foremost being a lawyer, an arbitrator, and a winter enthusiast. I think she's a bit of a skier, if I may say so. So welcome, Angela. How do you feel about being in this podcast?
Thank you so much for having me. Hello, everyone. Yeah, it's a very strange feeling because, as I said, you know, I would do anything to help young people to express themselves. I don't feel any that I'm some kind of an extraordinary woman, but I think maybe I hope that it will be interesting to someone to listen to our conversation.
Yes, and the main focus of this series of the podcast is for me to introduce very normal women with extraordinary stories. So, and I believe that you're a right fit, and we should tell a bit to the audience why that is so. So my very first question is, we are in Lithuania, which is a very special country, and you have been a witness of both Soviet Union and post-Soviet Union times. So maybe you would like to throw light upon how it is now to be in the post-Soviet Union time and how different it was back then.
Yeah, so basically it was way much worse back then. I vividly remember that time. Of course, I was a child. I was 8 years old when we regained our independence. But, you know, it did not change in one night. It kind of carried with us for a little while. It still carries right now as well. But of course, a lot of things have changed. And we are talking about that it did not change enough. And, you know, if something is bad in Lithuania, we're saying that, oh, it's like it was in Soviet times and you're acting like a Soviet or something. It's the biggest insult you can have in Lithuania. So, but I think maybe sometimes we are exaggerating because, you know, that not in Western countries we see only good behavior and no bureaucracy or something like that. But I think that that separating from the Soviet Union, I think that gave us a huge optimism that we can achieve like anything because it was a huge huge change, which we were responsible, that we never gave up. So as a nation, I think we have this resilience and this, you know, a very huge force in us that we can do is that we can make it. If we did that, we can do anything. And of course, we changed, like economy changed, like in the biggest sense possible. I don't know, also freedom of speech and et cetera, et cetera. But as a society, we also changed with exploring and implementing what we were deprived of during the Soviet Union times. But of course, we are left with a lot of things from back then. For example, that we are a nation of writers rather than speakers, which you can experience yourself because we were taught how to write, not ever to speak. Therefore, our politicians are faced with the struggles of how to express themselves, how to communicate, and so on and so forth. But these are little details. This change is a very huge one. I'm very happy that I have experienced both, you know, that I know and how to cherish what we do have right now.
Yeah, that's very interesting for me to know because I come from India and we have a different freedom fight as in comparison to here because I think there was a far more oppression in terms of freedom of speech here. But maybe you can also tell us a little bit about Lithuania, how it is back then, how was it back then and how it is now, and what is the biggest change that you see in women of today, the younger generation of today, other than the fact that I believe the freedom of speech is more lucid now than it was back then.
Yeah, sure. So I think, you know, the biggest change I felt was that we gained access to of the world, how it was. We were able to discover the truth, the reality that existed. And we gained a possibility to discover that truth ourselves. So we were not deprived of any information that was, you know, some kind of books were not allowed, some kind of music and so on and so on. With women, it's an interesting point because in Soviet times, everybody had to work. And women had to work as well in the office and at home. And after the independence, the situation was like, we will free the women and they can now stay at home, which was not a very good thing, because I think you could go for a maternity leave for 5 or 6 years back then after we regained independence. And so it was not a good thing for women, actually, for a short period of time. But in Soviet Union, despite the fact that all women had to work, it was not a good thing because nobody talked about what women do at home, because it was, you know, they did everything. They did the same as men at work and then came home and did everything at home. So that was, although in a labor market, it seemed like equality, but it wasn't. So that changed, of course. But I think now, you may be struggling with the equality, gender equality here in Lithuania more than in other countries, but the difference is not as huge as it was, you know, before, like 20 years ago, or 25, 30 years ago in Lithuania. So I think, you know, it changes. I think the biggest problem is now with LGBT, this side of equality. A bigger problem based on the statistics and in reality I face every day. But yeah, basically but again, compared to Soviet times, it's better right now. I didn't know any homosexual person back then during the Soviet times. Now I know.
Yeah, these are thoughts, right? Because often we try to articulate the way we think it is right in our head, and you know, it's for each their own. Mm-hmm. But I also have to ask you, because now we're discussing a bit of heavy topics. Hopefully we will discuss a bit of more lighter topics. What are your, of course, the word war itself is very uncomfortable. And we're living in a world today that we hear war constantly, you know, it's like a blast from the past coming back to the present. So what are your thoughts on it? As a lawyer, as a human, we condemn it. But also, being a bit of the Soviet Union life that you lived, seeing, you know, a neighboring brother country or a sister country going through this kind of bitter experience or loss of life, and what can I be put into words? So what are your thoughts on it, and do you see an end to it?
Yeah, definitely not a lighter topic. Yeah, so I think it's easier right now after almost 2 years have passed. I'm talking about the war in Ukraine, of course. It fascinates me maybe mostly from the psychological side, because at first there was like a bunch of emotions, you know, it affected the daily life in a very huge way. Like you were always checking the news and all the conversation were about the war. We stopped buying things, nice things, at least I did, you know, for a year. No Christmas presents, no anything, because, you know, we wanted somehow in all the ways possible to relate to that. And now it has changed, and I don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but of course, as a lawyer, I think it's a black and white situation. I don't know, you know, there is a resolution of the United Nations General Assembly calling it a war. So I, you know, do not have any legal comments into that. From the legal point of view, from the you know, humanitarian or social and any other point of view, I'm very much against it. And it's I think we are not we have for some reason, because we have a history with occupation and how the things were done, the lies and how those politicians talked back then, it's a vivid reminder every day, you know. So I think it brings anger together with the other feelings. Anger is at least it was at first the biggest feeling I had. But I think, you know, when we are grown-ups, the war is not as horrible as you are a child. I see a huge impact on children. At least I saw that in the beginning. For example, my son stopped sleeping, you know, and he was very much afraid and didn't know actually that he was. And we had to talk it through. And then I remember when I was a child, the nightmare I had was about the war, that we are in the war. And I thought maybe that because we, in sense, we were. But now when I talk to my son, it's all also the thing which scares children the most, the war. So, yeah, that is the thing I would wish like extinct in the world as a number one.
Yeah, and to close this topic, of course, like we know each other through the international sphere of things. We work with international law, and sometimes, you know, being a lawyer especially, we do feel that it all makes sense when everything is crystal, and it doesn't make sense when it starts melting. I'm sure you shall a similar opinion, or maybe not, and I would like to hear from you. So what do you feel about the whole situation of international law with the United Nations, and whether it's being recognized as a war or not? And because most often the general public thinks that the United Nations have a huge bandwidth of power where they can just, you know, announce an order or a statement, and then because all the member countries are bound by the treaties, they are inclined to follow it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe would you like to say what kind of a body United Nations is and how their comments are just not, you know, it's not binding, or, mm-hmm. you know, it's just a recommendation?
Mm-hmm.
Because there seems to be a lot of criticism on why United Nations is not doing this. And mm-hmm. so how do you feel about that?
Well, I feel that this topic, I like to see it edited from the legal philosophy point of view, like what is international law in general, that it is in its essence limited in itself, because all the states are equals under international law. So, you know, you kind of, that is the power you have, the thing you have to deal with. So in light of that, I share maybe some of the criticisms, but again, I think compare that we don't have the United Nations. So what could be better than the organization like United Nations? So I think that it's better like this than nothing. But again, I see the limits in international law. I'm not an expert in like state-to-state international relationships, and maybe the United Nations could do better and could do more and impose. But even if, for example, now we impose like in the European Union sanctions to Russian people, Russian companies, it does not achieve its purpose. And its aim, so because it's impossible. You have to. It's very difficult when one of the players does not play based on the rules. So it's difficult because if you violate those essential rules, it's the only way to win against Russia. But you cannot do this because if you violate this, then it's over. There are no boundaries left. So it's like an equal fight. And we have to be very, very smart to think it over and find a way which would not violate those principles which we cherish for so many years.
Yeah, and I think the next topic that I'm getting at is also, you know, something that's law related. So in terms of your professional career, what do you think is the biggest challenge that you face as a woman, as a lawyer? And for the audience, you are also an arbitrator. An arbitrator, in other words, is a judge. Mm-hmm. It must be very different to make these decisions. And there is a lot of like operational behind it legally, but there is a lot of like, it also associates with the kind of guilt, you know, and mm-hmm. when you have to give a decision,
mm-hmm.
Psychologically, how does it work? And what do you think is the biggest challenge?
Psychologically, it's way more difficult for me to be an attorney than an arbitrator.
Okay.
So, and as an arbitrator, I feel very comfortable because I'm objective and impartial, and I just have to be honest with myself. I do not have to think about the expectations of the client, which I deal with every day as an attorney, whether I manage to guess correctly, you know, to feel the correct needs, whether I asked correct questions, et cetera, et cetera. As an arbitrator, I maybe I have a thorough statistics of my cases, which I keep a record on, you know, about the amounts, about the jurisdictions, and so on and so forth. So I'm now on the 28th case from 2015. So it was one case where I actually faced some sleepless nights and struggled with a decision. But then, yeah, again, after I adopted that, maybe after a month, I managed to forget it and, you know, to deal with how it was. In other cases, it's, you know, it's a very comfortable area, I guess, because you have to work alone, to read a lot, to analyze a lot, which I love doing. So to be an arbitrator is the activity I love second most, because the first most is my work with my students. So second most is my role as an arbitrator, which, yeah, I feel very comfortable with and very happy. So no struggles there.
Mm-hmm.
With first appointments, I guess, it was 2015 when I got the first appointment, and I was like then 33 years old. So I don't know. I don't think it's too young. I think that's kind of a time, but it was not like from the first year I started to get 5 appointments or 3. It was one first year, maybe 2016. No appointments. Then as of 2017, there were 3-6 appointments a year. So, yeah, so the struggle was to get started as an arbitrator. I guess the struggle which I don't know how I overcame. I don't have any advice to any young people how to get your first appointment. I think maybe the answer would be for every lawyer, for the majority, do networking, you know, speak in the conferences. I did not do any of that, nothing. What I did, I attended a PhD in the field of arbitration. I acted as a counsel in arbitration cases, and I taught arbitration law at the university. So this is the you know, the road which I'm comfortable with, which I believe in, not because I wanted to get an appointment as an arbitrator, because I really love doing those things, you know, in general. So I don't know how I got those first appointments. I'm glad I did, you know, but it's not a very huge market here in Lithuania, but I'm very happy with the case load I have.
I will always think that it's the best thing to be by yourself and do things by yourself and for yourself. And of course, like your journey was more on the merit side of things, and knowing you as well, I know that, you know, the word network and all these complicated things that most often not work for everybody, you know, because it also comes with specific skill sets. It also comes with other associations with people that you have. But I know that law works, especially cases, work on a confidential basis. So we are not allowed to discuss in detail. But is there anything that you would like to say on any specific case that where you really thought that, you know, wow, I mean, this is crazy that people do this for a living? Any disputes that you come across, or are you kind of like you just listen to it and then you pass your rational and you kind of get over it and never think about it?
Yes. I'm never judgmental towards the party, no matter the qualifications, because sometimes it differs a lot. You know, one party has an extremely high level counsel, the other party has an in-house lawyer, and it comes from another jurisdiction. So I face that, but basically I don't want to see a procedure which depends on the quality of what counsel does. So basically, and especially if the counsel comes from another jurisdiction, I don't know, you know, how they act and how they operate. So I'm not the one to judge that it's a good job they did or a bad job they did. So, you know, I kind of keep the requirement on the minimum. So no surprises, I guess, there. But yeah, the subject matters of cases are sometimes very interesting. For example, if it pertains to food or beverages, it happens that after the deliberations or after hearing, you go to the store and buy the products that you talk
and
about.
And it's completely different to see it again. Because if you're hungry and you're talking and the experts are talking about how that product becomes that and this, yeah, and showing photos. And
So those funny moments, it happens that, you know, it affects my personal life, yeah, and my dinner choice.
Yeah.
But otherwise, yeah, it's very, very interesting to observe.
Yeah. Now, I think we've discussed a bit of law. So I think it's only fair to discuss, if not law, then what? What would have you been doing now?
So I was seriously considering to become a journalist. Okay. I'm very, extremely happy that
I did not choose this phantom,
because I think I would have gone to investigative journalism, to difficult things. And I'm not very good with people, you know, with the people I don't know, which is, I think, the quality which in journalism.
Investigation, you mean like crime, right? But just not
crime, politics, whatever, not, you know, like show business or like making stories about the Brown of Day or something like
that. That's not like Bridget Jones, darling.
No, definitely not. But I think because I see the trend in my life that when I see a direction towards something difficult in its essence, I go towards that. So I think that's where I would have gone. And I'm happy I did not, because that would have been a very difficult job to do. So other thing I loved was the language, but the grammar. I really love Lithuanian language, although I use a lot of English words while I'm talking Lithuanian. My spoken language is not clean, precise. But I did enjoy analyzing how the language works, how it changes, why it changes, and so on and so forth. But the fact was that I did not enjoy Lithuanian literature, the books we had to read at school. So that what scared me, that I will have to do way more reading of those books, and even more not interesting books at the university. And I was actually bribed by my grandfather to choose law studies. Mm-hmm. So I did. I was in love back then. If you know one extraordinary story, I was in love. I wanted to go to Vilnius University. That was out of the option because my parents graduated from Vilnius University. My brother was studying. So Vilnius University was like, yeah, the only way to go. And I wanted to be somewhere in Antakalnis region where my then boyfriend lived. So that
the one, but I wanted it.
Yeah, in Antakalnis, that it kind of coincided with my grandfather's request, and that was a coincidence.
For those of who are seeing this now and who do not know what Antakalnis is, it's a bit of the forest region, right?
Yeah, yeah, so it's close to the law faculty.
Oh, that one.
It's very close to the law faculty. That's where I lived for 5 years when I was studying.
Okay. And also to discuss a little bit about sports. And, you know, so I do know that you ski from time to time with your son. So yeah. How about the passion? How, because I'm from the very south part of the world. It's today we have -9 or 10 or maybe more.
Okay, but for y'all, I'm like, what?
No, it's not -10. It's
more, maybe, real feel. Okay, but
yeah, we get it. So outside, there's a lot of snow. It's pretty nice. So how does it feel to ski? You know, what it is to be skiing?
It's a very liberating or...
Yes.
Yeah, it is a very sensitive topic because this winter we are skipping our ski trip. It's like saying I will block all social media during the period not to see how my friends are going there.
Yeah.
But I think that it cleans your mind. Mm-hmm. I learned being outdoors and doing something. Mm-hmm. And in the mountains, it's kind of a perfect version of that,
yeah,
because you're always outside, but you're not cold because I'm always cold. Otherwise, I'm all
I know.
Cold. And when I ski, I'm not.
Yeah.
I think that the feeling I love the most when you are top on the mountains and you're starting to ski and you feel like, you know, like all alone and that everything is possible. Because, you know, you see how big the world is and how small you are. It means that your problems are very small. It means that they're possible to solve. So that is like every time I go skiing, I come back with new ideas, with a bunch of optimism that I will, you know, change myself, change something around me. So, but I'm not a very good skier. That's I have to.
I fully admit.
No. Yes, I'm very afraid afraid of heights. But in the mountains, I don't feel it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm afraid of the speed of high speed. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I'm always slowing myself because I'm afraid of losing control. Yes, 20 years ago, I think I would have gone to the black slopes then, the most difficult ones. But now when I'm raising a child, that gives me a responsibility
to be cautious and stay alive. Yeah. I've actually tried skiing just once and with my brother, and it did not go too well because, of course, for obvious reasons, I grew up by the sea. So it's not an activity that's easy for us. But maybe, you know, this podcast would help some first-time skiers.
Yeah.
So what would you think you would give as an advice to a person who's just like imaginatively standing on their first ski slopes with their ski sticks and trying to do their pizza and something else?
No.
So what do you tell them when they have their first fall?
Okay, so I fell many times. First of all, I started to understand how to ski on my third skiing trip. So that's a very normal thing not to be able to do it from at first. So it was the third time I went, and I would suggest maybe watching YouTube videos.
It's probably the theory of skiing.
Yeah, it's actually helpful for me. It wasn't. I watched them. It didn't help. But it was one phrase my mother told me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
He said,
mm-hmm.
at first one leg works and then another,
mm-hmm.
one and another. And then I got it, like from that one sentence. Mm-hmm. So I think everyone should somehow find that one sentence which describes the essence in it. It kind of, you know, opened the gate. And then I started to ski effectively, you know, because otherwise everyone can do it, but you feel like your whole body works. When my one friend said very accurately that skiing is a sport for lazy people.
Yes, you can listen to
that all can hear. Because when you see it, when I see it, my watch, activity,
yeah,
it's a very low activity when you're skiing.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, compared to what I do otherwise,
yeah,
or exercise.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, because you can do it whole day.
Yeah,
no, you could not do, you know, like with dumbbells or kettlebell training session for 8 hours.
Yeah,
skiing, it's possible, you know, well, 6 hours a day.
Yeah,
that's manageable. So, but I offer to everyone because it's a very good for your health, psychological and physical health, both.
Yeah, I guess nothing comes from the get-go. So maybe my next skiing trip, I will try and find a sentence, you know, from someone.
Yeah. Do you know how to ride a bike?
I do.
Yeah. So let's try to think about that.
Yeah.
That you don't need another leg doing this turn.
Yeah.
And then you don't need another leg.
Yeah.
The rest. So, and it comes, you know, then to you.
Yes. Yeah, I hope so. Let's see this winter season, who's going to ski and Rishad. The next topic I would like to ask you is about, I know you're an avid reader, and I know you like books, and I know you have a lot of them. Uh-huh. So which is your, maybe the book that changed you or changed your life philosophy, and why? And why would you recommend it?
Yeah, I would maybe say two books. One from my childhood. It was a book, Uncle Tom's Cabin. It was not like it changed me, because I don't have a book which changed me as a person. I think all the books I read influenced me. I like, you know, Astrid Lindgren books as I was a child. A lot of Hermann Hesse or other Austrian German writers who wrote about the lonely person, about the importance of friendship, and so on and so forth. So there were various periods in my life where I read different kind of books. But the book affected me the most was Uncle Tom's Cabin. It was a book, I remember when I read it, where I read it. It was at my grandparents' house in Kaunas. And it affected me because at first time I cried when I was reading the book. And it was a very strong feeling about the power of the book, or the power of writing, how it can, you know, like go straight into you. And yeah, it was about the merits, about the kindness of a human being, like how a person can be very good and bad also, and that is a choice that you can always choose, and you should look at the merits at the human being as it is, because of course it is a book about the discrimination, about the slavery. So that touched upon the harsh situation in the United States before the abolishment of slavery there. But it brought a lot of human, a lot of things which you, that the topic that fascinates me about the human being, that's how much you can control over what you're doing and what you're thinking, and that you always have to be very alert with yourself. So in the book, how the humanity came to that point that they considered some people like not people at all. So that brought me a lot of thoughts and feelings back then, because, you know, we did not have any black people back then in the Soviet Union. So that was a huge shock to me. And it was, you know, of course, about the love, about friendship, and so on and so forth. But this is the book I remember the most from my childhood. And another one from, it will sound maybe very cheesy, and I don't know whether it's a good book or something, but it was a book by Sheryl Sandberg, Lean In. So that kind of opened my eyes because there was a lot of statistics there given. Mm-hmm. And I found a lot of myself in that book. Mm-hmm. A lot of things I considered correct, which was incorrect. And yeah, so it was like a trigger for mm-hmm. me to be more objective and to work with myself, not from that perspective, like I'm a victim as a woman mm-hmm. and that it's unfair, mm-hmm. but from that point of view that I have a lot of stereotypes myself mm-hmm. and that I have to work with myself mm-hmm. in order not to have them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it's the work still going on, and I think it will continue because it's very hard to overcome. But yeah, that was, and also I remember how I read the book, where I read it. It was near the lake in Trocaid.
What?
It just was dying. And everyone was swimming in the lake. And I was, what? And it was like, I want to stand up and for us to shout.
I think the best feeling is when a book really consumes you and everything else like just shuts, you know, and it's just you and the book and you're living in it. And your something, some switch in your brain just like clicks and then your life changes. And I really hope like, you know, a lot of us get to read such books. And it's very interesting to hear from someone else what really changed for them. So we've come to the final bits of the podcast. And I think that, you know, we've discussed in length about different, what feminism means to you, what it is to live here, and how law has changed you, why did you want to be a lawyer, and so on and so forth, and also your love for statistics and your best legal and human philosophies, and also about the skiing. I really enjoyed that. But, I mean, for most people, I live in Lithuania now. I'm married to a Lithuanian, so... So it brought me to Lithuania. And as a lawyer, and it's definitely different, you know, for people who don't know where it is. But most people's first question is because they are lack of geographical knowledge, be oblivious. So how it is for you to recommend people to live in Lithuania, and why do you think it is special, you know, in simple words? For many people living back home, it's home, you know, it's an mm-hmm. undescribable feeling of comfort and warmth and yes. so on. But from one standpoint, if you have to recommend Lithuania for people to come, visit, live, you know, what do you think it's made of?
Yeah, it's a very difficult question. I think that you would be the judge of that because you have a fresh eyes. it's my home, as you described. Yeah, I'm very loyal to my country, my university, my family. So, you know, I love my country unconditionally. But yeah, compared to other countries, what I would say that it's a very tolerant environment, at least in Vilnius. But I could maybe only tell this for Vilnius city, not other parts of Lithuania. It's a very tolerant because that you can actually feel comfortable here. And if you find a connection with some of the people, you will be able to find a very true connection here because, you know, I think that Lithuanians are quite sincere people when communicating with others. And we are curious and very hospitable. Like, you know, we want to know the traditions of other people, to know the food, to know the holidays, the religion, and so on and so forth. Economy-wise, at some point, it was like cheaper to live there and work for, you know, like remotely to have a base here, but to work in a country with a higher level of economy development. But now I think that's changing. Mm-hmm. Vilnius is becoming more expensive, even for me.
The pie.
Yeah, well, compared to Paris, London, of course not. But yeah, still, you should decide on the price-wise. It might be, but at the same time, I think that, for example, the best restaurants in Lithuania are quite cheap compared to the high-level restaurants in other Western countries. So that's a good thing because I have friends who are coming here to eat in our those best restaurants because it's cheaper, way cheaper to get a very high-quality food. So, yeah. And also, if you are like basketball player,
yes,
it's okay. There will be a lot of things to discuss. Also, but basically, yeah, the things I value the most is the tolerance towards people, the openness and hospitality, I would say. Those are the main things.
Yeah, it's always lovely to speak with you, to chat with you. And thank you for coming on my first episode and discussing this with me. And it's only fair if we end the episode by you telling a very cliche thing about why you enjoy or why you have come to some kind of like peace with yourself being a woman and what do you feel about it today as of this moment being a woman?
Being a woman, the fact is that I never identified myself as a woman. I started to do it maybe very late in my life. So it is a very difficult question because when I was a child, I was growing with my brother. And I was like mirroring my brother's life. And my grandmother was telling me that she was telling, oh, my sweet girl. And I was saying, I'm not a girl, I'm a boy. I would like the gender actually to disappear as a decisive, as an important factor in many, many areas of life. It's just a human being. Of course, with caring a child, giving birth, there are differences, but I'm not a believer in different views, different like needs of men and women.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's my personal choice. So as a woman, I feel as a human being.
And it's a great athlete.
Put this that I feel like this because I am a woman. I need this because I'm a woman.
Yeah, so. That's absolutely beautiful to know. And I think that's how it should be. With that, thank you very much, Aigle, for coming on your first episode. And I hope everybody who's listening enjoyed it. Everybody who's watching liked it. And hopefully I'll be back with my next guest. So thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you very much.